Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
Saura, saura, banyan ing auna, hugamer fein on saura lin. Saura buina noni ni leial, hugamer fein on saura lin. Sunday Miscellany in the Aorist, they said. Think of something summary, and so I said I would. Because it's Sunday Miscellany, after all. And I'd only ever once been in the Aorist in all my life, and that was well over 20 years ago. And so, higme egan mord, agus dechme amach. I sat at my desk, looking out at the fields and the trees, thinking of something summery. But all I could see was unvashtach. The rain, unvashtach. Eeg grada bashti, it pelting rain. Or beating, trouncing down with rain, igrada bashti, or eeg kaila bashti, which is driving, twisting, coiling rain, eeg laska bashti, which is lashing or whipping or flogging down with rain, eeg kur dawar, which is raining torrents or pouring with floods. It was useless, it was impossible. How could I possibly write about warm, sunny, sultry things? I put the whole notion aside and left it for a few days. But sure enough, when I sat back down at the desk and looked out again, Vishef os eg kur. It was still, well, eg kur means putting, but actually it also means raining. Vishe eg kur. Eg kur gan steana, it was raining ceaselessly. Now, eg kur can also mean ploughing and sowing and burying. And propelling, and setting out, and laying down, and countless other things. But more often than not, tosheg kur means it's raining. So tosheg kur bashti eg kur farne, it's raining. But even when you use eg kur to refer to sowing or ploughing or burying, it's normally raining at the same time. So tamakur shi lagus eg kur, I'm sowing seed and it's raining. Things went on like this for a long time. But today's deadline was drawing nearer. But still, whenever I looked out at that window, vishe eg rilla bashti. Rilla means streaming with rain. Eg rilla conveys the idea that the rain was like oats through a riddle, or water through a sieve. Vishe eg ligernach bashti. It was pelting. Ligernach makes clear that the rain feels like little pebbles are being lobbed at you. Ligernach. Eg bludernach bashti. Raining unpleasantly, as though sour milk or a hogwash was falling down from the sky. Vishe eg dal hurt. It was raining so heavily you couldn't see ahead. Vitu dal, you were blinded. Vishe eg rogaile boshti. It was pouring a noisy, tumultuous form of rain. And so I thought about pulling out, saying it just wasn't working for me. But then I remembered how much I wanted to visit the Aorist again after all these years. And so I soldiered on, hoping that there might be a turra, a cessation of rain, or even just a sawness, a lull in a rainstorm. Maybe even an achel, a fine spell between showers, or a bruachta, a sudden appearance of the sun after rain. Ní fada gamerche is spalpasus, would soon clear up, but no. Instead came rashta, rain driven furiously by the wind, and gledernach, a downpour of rain that seems combative or warlike, and team, teeming rain. Team refers to straining off water or liquid, such as teeming potatoes, as in draining the cooking water from them. That's where the word teem for potatoes comes from. Cuma cahain adechin amachan in og. No matter when I looked out that bloody window, vishe cahav scanna gdeasi. It was throwing cobbler's knives, which is the Irish way of saying cats and dogs. Eg cahav scanna gdeasi. You can also say eg cur fork agus scanna, raining forks and spoons. I became the ultimate weather watcher, a fichar, a person who observes ravens for signs of weather change, a nailador, a person who cloud watches to predict the weather, a reador, someone who stargazes to gauge the weather. But there was no point. All I saw was baska, a drenching or beating from rain, a batter fightinne, a pounding, battering, or a sudden downpour of rain. Vias egdeja in the pjeba. I was at the end of my tether. Until I realized, of course, that this is radio. Sunday Miscellany is radio. No one can see me. They can't see what I see. I don't actually need to inflict the misery beyond my window on others. So I could bring light. I could bring a list of the most light-filled words, the sunshiniest, beautiful, bright words. And that would get the job done. It would get me to the Aras, no matter what the weather was. And so, I can share with you all, Arina Oishla, the words that have been moving me this wonderful summer and the early autumn. Well, Lunruch is one. It means bright, shining, luminous, and resplendent. And Sailshach, bright and effulgent and luminous. And Gialonach, gleaming and flashing. And Gradonach, bright and intense. And Niavruch, splendid and bright and radiant. Or Surucha, luminous, bright and cheerful. Or Ruhinach, gleaming, radiant, sparkly. Or Gleinach, vivid and bright. Or Trilshach, glittering bright. And the colour Grian Vui, the colour of golden sunlight. Grian Vui. Saura, saura, banya na gauna, hugamar fein on saura len, saura bui, na noni ni legal, hugamar fein on saura len.
During my working life, I've had offices in some of Dublin's most iconic buildings. The Custom House, Croke Park, Dublin Castle. But of all the offices where I've sat in solitude behind a desk, by far the most unusual was in Kilmainham Jail. I still have the little booklet, Ghosts of Kilmainham, from my first overwhelming and fascinating visit there, aged six. The front cover features a bayonet-wielding British soldier looking in on a disconsolate prisoner. On the back, another prisoner looks out to freedom through the bars of his cell. On the inside of the cover, I've scrawled my name. A couple of decades on, a fairly fresh history graduate, I could hardly have been more excited when I walked through Kilmainham's imposing doorway on my first day of work. And I couldn't wait to see my office in the East Wing, which was a prison cell. Even if you've never been to Kilmainham Jail, chances are you've probably seen the East Wing on screen. This cathedral-like space, designed by architect John McCurdy and completed in 1861, has featured in many movies. It's the prison in The Italian Job that criminal Michael Caine is released from, and where the job's mastermind, Noel Coward, is fated with chance of England. England. It's the prison setting for In the Name of the Father, about the Guildford Four, starring Daniel Day-Lewis and Pete Postlethwaite. More recently, it's where a certain lovable bear does time in Paddington 2. For the 6 years that I managed Kilmainham Jail, I did my admin, answered queries, and got a break from staff and visitors in my East Wing cell, a double cell with a fireplace and a large window. Totting up those hours, I think I spent the equivalent of an 8-month prison sentence there, significantly longer than most of the famous political prisoners. The leaders of the 1916 Rising, whose executions in Kilmainham Stonebreaker's Yard changed the course of Irish history, spent only days there, or, in the case of James Connolly, just a few tragic minutes. Thomas Francis Marr and William Smith O'Brien were held briefly in Kilmainham before being transported. Charles Stuart Parnell served a sentence roughly equivalent to mine, but apparently in even more comfortable surroundings. Anne Devlin, who spent over 3 years in Kilmainham between 1803 and 1806, was probably its longest-serving political prisoner. But as well as the who's who of Irish history, over 100,000 ordinary prisoners did time in Kilmainham from the late 18th to the early 20th century. Among these were William Kirwan, convicted of a murder on Ireland's Eye in 1852, and the men from Mamtrasna, County Galway, who were wrongly convicted of murder. But the vast majority are long forgotten. People whose crimes ranged from the most base and heinous to stealing bread to survive. When I walked Kilmainham's corridors, I think about those prisoners. 7-year-old Alicia Kelly, one of the youngest known prisoners, incarcerated for stealing a cloak. Belfast carpenter James Lawler, jailed for stealing the wheel off a cart, built the chapel altar where Joseph Plunkett would later marry Grace Gifford, hours before his execution in 1916. Patrick Kilkenny, who in 1866 was the last person publicly executed in Dublin, and one Mary O'Neill, who, over the course of a single year after the famine, was sentenced to 3 months for larceny of 1 shilling and 2 pence, 1 month for loitering with intent, 1 month for having a stolen peacock, and 12 months hard labour for stealing a bonnet. I'd also go to areas associated with ordinary prisoners that were off the normal tour. The hanghouse where criminal executions were carried out, the basement laundry where the female prisoners worked, the plunge baths where prisoners were washed once a week, the infirmary where the sick were looked after, the punishment cells where the recalcitrant were kept in darkness for 24 or 48 hours on bread and water, and where I often ate my lunch, the large exercise yard at the back of the prison. Eventually, I left Kilmainham to occupy another office, one where I could hear the crowd of All-Ireland final roar. But I've never forgotten Kilmainham Jail. 100 years ago this year, Kilmainham finally closed. The last prisoners were Ernie O'Malley and Eamon De Valera. Fitting names to bring an end to a place so integral to our history. But should you visit the jail and learn of Kilmainham's sweep of Irish history, you'll walk up the stone stairs to the Catholic chapel. And when you do, make sure you feel the worn and unevenness underneath your feet. And perhaps spare a thought for the multitude of ordinary prisoners in whose silent footsteps you walk.
How hard is my fortune, how vain my repining. The strong rope of death for this young neck is twining. My strength is departed, my cheeks sunk and sallow.
My friend Owen is an astrophysicist. He spent 4 years building a telescope in Offaly, something to do with the sun and black holes. Look, I know a lot about family constellations and less than nothing about spatial ones, but I don't think it's all that unconnected. How relationships are forged and formed and mutated over many, many years. I like the constellation of me and Owen talking about stars and the possibilities of time travel. I do not like talking to Owen about astrology and spiritualism and how he speaks to my dead grandmother, things that remain in the intolerable realm of faith and mystery. If you really want to be humbled, argue with a scientist about star signs. But astrology comes from the position of planets, and it's really old, and I trust old things, old people, old buildings, old remedies, old religions, old ways of doing Now, in fairness, I pick and choose because not all old things are good things. But there's got to be something in it if it survived that long. When an elephant is in labour, the other females in the herd form a protective circle around her. And when the baby plops onto the ground, they stroke it with their trunks, imprinting themselves on her as her caretakers. They don't ruminate an indecision beforehand, thinking, am I intruding, though? If I go over with my trunk... I mean, there's loads of trunks already stroking the baby. I don't want to be annoying. The mother elephant doesn't squirm with guilt or protest the attention paid her, knowing that she needs this support for her and the baby to survive because it is the only way to survive. In the therapy room, a woman tells her therapist how it's impossible to take an hour away from her disabled child. She says there's no one around. She doesn't want to burden them. They roll their eyes, she says. They do not lay their trunks. It's not their fault. They have busy lives and families of their own. It's reasonable. And they're not aware of the impact on the woman who has heard the message, you're on your own, enough times to turn away from her own need and stop asking. On Instagram, she reads posts that say, what happened isn't your fault, but healing is your responsibility. And five ways to say no. And feeling needy, it's probably your insecure attachment style. Maybe her family and friends are practicing saying no. She needs to learn to take responsibility for her circumstances. Maybe she needs a life coach. She wants to respect people's boundaries, but it's so hard to get through a day, and why does she feel so angry? Another woman is so depressed she doesn't see the point of living, and when she tells her friends, they change the subject. They don't have the time to circle around her. They tell her to get help, so she goes to a therapist, the great replacement for human connection at 70 euro an hour. Mental health campaigns say, reach out. But what if there's no hands to reach to? We're telling people to reach out while not helping others to reach in. I read a poem recently that ended with the line, we have so little of each other now, so far from fire and tribe. We are so far from fire and tribe, so far from it takes a village, from the knowledge that a stranger's child is our child. Our neighbor's trauma is our trauma, our addiction, our poverty, our joy, our penance, our guilt, our forgiveness. So far from answering the phone when you can just text instead, from borrowing sugar, dropping the baby in for 2 minutes. Why express your distress when you can talk to a therapy chatbot 24/7 for a monthly subscription? We can Google it, get it delivered, order it in, read reviews, download a mindfulness app. We don't need to need each other anymore. We've cured our codependency, healed our traumas, we practice self-care, utilize boundaries, cut out toxic people. We know our worth. We're determined that now we have emigrated from the trembling land of the heart, we cannot risk going back to that place. We can ask Alexa. Now, maybe I'm just cynical, I don't know, but I do know is that if I'm experiencing something, it's part of the constellation of humanity, and therefore I'm never experiencing it alone. Because despite how we live, it is we, not I, that forms the survival of the species. Look, the holiest moments of my life are not in prayer or sitting in meditation before a lit candle. The holiest moments of my life are the calls to connection. Nothing special, a missed call to reciprocate, being sent a meme, a request for help, an offer of a lift. It sounds so stupid now I'm saying it, but the profundity of this simplicity is only apparent in its lack. This holy prayer... I am with you. I am with you. So I try to be like an elephant, standing in a circle of my sisters, unapologetically laying my trunk over the newborn baby's damp skin. Thank you.
Kalengile, pipi kalengile, kapaka samba. Tula kalele, mwana bitoto, kapiki la kafa.
Hermit of Glendalough, for Lillian Dalton. Saint Kevin of Glendalough, in all his quietness and solemnity, never thought of himself as holy. His love of words and prayer were always for others. His self didn't exist. When he was younger, he could carry fire close to his chest. It would never burn nor scar. Older Kevin would recite psalms from the holy book in the freezing stream of goodwill. One day he lost the book of prayer. A otter retrieved it and proffered it up on the tip of its snout, in pristine condition and dry. The same otter caught salmon for him and all in his monastery. The otter had small ears and good hearing. When a monk suggested the otter's pelt would make smashing gloves to help banish their chilblains, the otter scarpered. Stories travelled about how close to nature Kevin was, about the white cow, the giving cow, the sheep that were gone but not gone. The blackbird was famous. When the wild boar was being hunted by man and hounds, they came across Kevin on his knees in prayer. Birds perched on his shoulders. The hounds lay down in a docile stretch. The boar ran free. Kevin the hermit, ascetic of Glendalough, renewed in prayer, his internal barometer only clocking up calm. A bed of stone, a pillow of rock, a prayer for every living thing, a word without malice. Amen. Edict in memory of Marilyn Conway. Go to Thurbjog and sing for her. Take only left turns. Pass out the white thorn, but remember to pay homage. Admire it as it should be admired. Pay no heed to the Pishog Brigade. Stay with her, Lundov. Perch and be ready. Watch out for straws in the wind. Eggshells, a lone magpie, a windy goat, mistletoe out of season. Keep an eye on regret. Jaywalker by day, shapeshifter by chance. And despair, a weasel waiting to lunge. Settle and sing, blackbird, sleep not.
I never met Edna O'Brien in person. When offered the opportunity of spending time in her company by our mutual friend, Alan Hayes of Arden House Publishers, I found myself assailed by a sudden, imposterous shyness, a feeling of dread panic that I would not measure up to what she might have expected of a writer from her own heartland, a writer to whom she had been so generous and so kind. Edna O'Brien's name and beautiful imprimatur adorned the cover of my first novel. She and I were distantly related through some weave of blood and marriage between my ancestors and hers from the small farms in the Calas of the Shannon and the hills of East Clare. My grandmother, May Barry, occasionally looked after Edna when she was a baby and May was a teenager, visiting her relatives in Chungraney, whose farm bordered the O'Brien farm. Years later, in 1960, my grandmother, by then May Ryan of Pallisbeg, went to great lengths to secure an illicit copy of Edna's censored debut, The Country Girls. This was the first book in a collection of banned volumes that grew into a substantial library of the scandalous and the illegal. May found herself in the position of secret librarian to the curious, the prurient, and the gently seditious, to people who longed for intellectual and philosophical freedom, and to people who, like her, just loved books. A path was beaten to the half door of her house, where she and her husband, my grandfather Martin Ryan, lived with their five children as caretaker farmers. She loaned out her O'Briens and McGaherns and Behans and Dunleavys to neighbours and friends and to all sorts of dignitaries from Nina and beyond, people who wouldn't ordinarily travel on foot along a boreen and across a field to visit a small house occupied by working people. My grandmother's underground railroad of books terminated on her death, but the memory of it is stitched closely into the fabric of my family's history. Edna O'Brien's name on the cover of my book took on a sacred relevance, the circularity seeming like fulfillment of a secret scripture written in the 30s by a teenager minding her neighbour's baby in Chumgraney, County Clare. I was presented with a scarf by Eileen Blake, Edna's sister, in 2018 at the Mount Shannon Festival of Arts. I was given a welcome so warm that day I was almost undone by it. It's impossible to feel worthy of such consideration. My mother often asked afterwards, on wintry days, "Is that the scarf they gave you in Tumgraney?" I would always answer that yes, it was. "Good," she'd say, "mind that scarf." That kind of a gift, in Mam's eyes, would always carry luck, a residue of goodness, of the spirit of its giving. Gifted gloves should always be returned, because they foretell a friendship's end. Gifted scarves should always be put to use. My mother held fast to her belief in the invisible forces that played in the ether around us. For all of her devotion to her Christian faith, she was from the pagan place that Edna O'Brien described with such an unerring eye and elegant hand, and she dwelt there for the length of her life. What would we have done without Edna O'Brien? No one needs me to tell them of the immensity of her stature, of her beauty, of her wild talent, of the battles she fought, the attacks she parried with such grace and style, how she was in the vanguard of the fearless people who rose from among us and blazed through the overgrowth of dogma and hegemony to clear a path, a safe and open path for all who followed, with a vision unadulterated by any inherited ideology or generational prejudice. She dismantled and transcended all of those barriers, and she stayed in the fight, her vitality undiminished, her voice always true. She has her seat forever now in a secular pantheon of the mighty and the good. On a lake island, in a broadening of the water between Clare and Tipperary, lies a warrior queen, from whose stilled hand across seven decades flowed rivers undammed of beauty and truth. I never met Edna O'Brien, and now I never will, but I thank her every day with all my heart. Thank you.
Hello again. You're nearly there. Is Anna Mordham Avensha a mask Alien Tory, Scrive Nori, Kyol Tory and Cade Scott. It's just such an honor to be here and so inspiring. These things are so important to get so inspired and take that on to the next journey. But speaking of County Clare, this is a song called Sing a Song of Old, written out of the rock and the seas and the lands of the burn.
Sing a song of old. Love the one you hold.
Camina Maggie, thank you.
gidal chasas minlam of wikis goolishne Helen Hurry Ilyog in a screen or is locked and kills Peter Gahiantak. I just want to say as well how we are honored to know Rissin Ruthron to have had such extraordinary talent made available this evening on Culture Night and built around, if you like, Santa Miscellany. Santa Miscellany, I've already said, is a wonderful. I've always liked the pace of it because it is also quite intergenerational. And it is also represents a kind of truthful tribute to memory and a sense of place and the imprint of the human on both events and on location. My poem, Stardust, was the opening poem I wrote 20 years ago for my collection, An Arid Season. That collection, I remember, An Arid Season was dedicated to Sabina and my children, and it was published by New Ireland. Stardust. It is of stardust we are molded by vapors and fragments from the making and breaking of galaxies. We are the broken bits of our cosmos, moved by traces of embedded memory, lurching always towards our image of hopes unrealized and fading. The promise of our as yet uncreated wholeness remains, however weak. From this flux we take refuge in the cell of reason. From that prison of categories our cry is heard, that we are not solely the children of reason. We have glimpsed the land of the heart. The turbulence of present time recedes. The stirring of that which is beyond time and space reverberates. Our wonder invites us to make a journey, to stand against the false certainties of lesser tasks and poorer versions. Out of exile, our words will make a plaintive discourse that echoes of a lost prophecy. Deep within, we hear it call, offering more than a refuge, making a fresh story of a new time and wondrous space, a promise of the as yet uncreated joy made out of stardust. Have we?
This morning's programme was the first of two special miscellany programmes from a Culture Night event hosted by President Higgins and Sabina Higgins at Áras an Uachtaráin. The readings were Saura by Manchón McGann, Ghosts of Kilmainham by Tim Carey, Response to Stardust was by Mia Doring. Two poems by Rita Ann Higgins, Hermit of Glendalough and Edict. A Pagan Place by Donal Ryan, and Stardust, a poem by Michael D. Higgins, President of Ireland. The music was Cadaishin Duntation by Cormac Begley, The Jail of Clun Mala by Donal Clancy and Áine McHugh, Can Zen Zen Zed, arranged and performed by Noel Sumbo and Eamon Cagney, Blackbird, also by Donal Clancy and Áine McHugh. And Sing a Song of Old was by Claire Sands. On sound for RTE were Gar Duffy and Liam Mullen. And our thanks to all at Áras an Uachtaráin for hosting this event. There'll be more from the gathering at the Áras on next week's programme. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and the producer is Sarah Binchy. And if you'd like to listen back to this programme or to RTE Radio's various other Culture Night offerings, you can go to rte.ie/radio or the RTE Radio app or rte.ie/culture. Culture Night is brought to you by the Arts Council in partnership with local authorities and cultural organisations throughout the island of Ireland.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.